This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycast.
Joy 94.9.
This is Gay News Week on Joy 94.9. Have your say. 1300 Joy 949.
Gay
News
Week.
Gay News Week on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
Good evening and welcome to Gay News Week on Joy 94.9 with Katie Larson,
Jeffrey Devine,
and myself, Matt Thompson. Here at Gay News Week, we cover topics that have been in the GLBTI news over the past week and how they impact on you, us, and our community.
And tonight's show, we're going to revisit the Commit to Community Radio campaign, and we'll get to that in just a moment. We're going to be talking to Andrew Dillon from the AFL about GLBTI issues within the AFL and how they're progressing. We're going to be talking about a supervised withdrawal program for GLBTI youth that exists, and it's a leader in that field nationally. And we've got two guests in the studio to go through that issue. Of course, then the national and international news roundups, which we do every week. So to get started, if you want to get in touch with us at any time to contribute, this is how you do so.
You're listening to the Gay Newsweek podcast with
Katie,
Jeffrey and Matt. Get in touch. Email gaynewsweek@joy.org.au or check out joy.org.au/gaynewsweek for all of the links to our social media pages.
Yes, of course. And one of the biggest stories that rocked the media world this week was the Commit to Community Radio campaign. Of course, we've been talking about this for a couple of weeks now, and the federal budget came out last night and it was very big news. Mm. And to discuss what kind of implications that budget is going to have on the future of digital radio in Australia, we're joined by Adrian Basso, the president of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia, and he's also the general manager of PBS. Good evening, Adrian.
Thank you for having me.
Adrian, so the government has failed to provide the mere $1.4 million in funding that we thought needed to support digital radio services. What does this mean for digital radio now, community digital radio?
Well, it means that the funding that we need is about 40% short. So we require about $3.6 million annually to run the project, and that's to have 37 stations across the country. So stations in Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, Adelaide and Perth have been broadcasting for the last couple of years. But the last budget in 2012 fell short. So in the meantime, we've been lobbying the minister and politicians to see if we can get something happening. But we felt that that was falling on deaf ears, and hence the campaign a couple of months ago.
What support do you think the campaign has brought to it?
Well, we've had 42,000 people sign up on the website, and a lot of that happened on the Commit to Community Radio Day of Action, which was on March the 13th last month, where we got a heap of support from around the country, and people signing up, sending emails to Minister Conroy, but also to their local MP. So there's this huge grassroots swell in support for community radio. So we're hoping budget night last night they would stump up the extra $1.4 million required, but they didn't. And we're now in a position where we haven't got the money to continue the services. So we're in a bit of a pickle at the moment.
What does this mean? So what's going to happen now if we don't, through some other means or through the government off budget, I guess, which is unlikely, get this $1.4 million?
So we're hoping to meet with the minister later this week and see what happens from there. But I'm very mindful that it's an election year. Mm. And so we're putting all our cards on the table and looking at all our options. And so that'll mean pursuing the parties and seeing where they stand. And hopefully we might be able to get some sort of election outcome from it.
What's Malcolm Turnbull's point of view as the opposition spokesman who presumably, if they win at election, will become the minister?
Well, to date, we've really focused on the government because the main purpose was to get some sort of result on budget night, and obviously it's the incumbent government that influences that. So today I've just been spending all day talking to community radio stations and commercial and ABC and lots of media just to highlight the issue at hand. Mm-hmm. So in the coming weeks we'll start that lobbying and see if we can get some sort of indication from any party really to see where they stand as far as community radio goes.
All right, so that's what you're doing. What do we need to do? What can we do to help the cause?
Well, people can still sign up to the website. So that's commit2communityradio.org.au. Mm-hmm. They can put their name down. They can send Minister Conroy an email. But importantly, by joining that list, then they're part of the group. And we'll keep them in the loop on things that we do. So whether we change tact and, say, look, we're going to approach these people, can you write to them? Mm-hmm. So that's a way of mobilising.
Right, power in numbers.
Pretty much. Right. So I was pretty amazed that we didn't get a result, mm-hmm. considering that the budget, they outlined an additional funding on top of the base funding for ABC and SBS of $100 million, the board estimates.
Big dollars.
And so we were looking at it just a few million dollars as compared to that. And also within the budget, they outlined again the relaxation of the free TV commercial license fees worth $600 million over the 4 years.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not big money at all for them, really.
No.
We're sitting on $1.4 million. That's all we needed. And it's just, frankly, not good enough. So commit to communityradio.org.au.
Yep.
Excellent. President of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia, Adrian Basso, thank you very much for joining us on Gay Newsweek.
Thank you.
Gay Newsweek.
Yes, it's Jeffrey, Katie and Matt with you this evening.
Yes, it is. And we have spoken quite a bit over the last few weeks and months about players coming out in professional sport and also some of the measures the AFL have been taking to introduce anti-homophobia measures into the game. We're joined on the line tonight by Andrew Dillon, who's the General Manager of National and International Development and General Counsel at the AFL. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
One of the things we've been particularly speaking about here previously is whether it is the AFL's responsibility to take a lead role in anti-homophobia measures and standards. Do you believe it is?
Yeah, I think the AFL definitely has a role to play. And in particular, I think our Players Association and through the players have got a role to play. And I think our Players Association and the players are doing that this week, and they've launched a campaign about, to stop shirking the issue and taking a pledge not to use homophobic language. And I think that's, and at the AFL, we're really supportive of the Players Association and the players who are doing that.
So some of the players that were doing that, obviously we've previously seen support from Brock McLean, who marched at Pride this year, but then more recently Joe Watson, Scott Pendlebury, Luke Ball and Daniel Jackson, just to name a few, who are publicly pledging not to use anti-gay remarks at all as part of the International Day Against Homophobia through the AFL Players Association. It's absolutely wonderful to see these players standing up. And how do you think that affects change in opinion and responses across the game?
Look, I think it's really good because the players, the players are role models and people look up to them, and I think it's really good for the players to take a leadership position on that, and I think that's better than any rules or regulations that the AFL can put in place. I think the players standing up and doing that is fantastic, and as I said before, we're really supportive of the fact that they're doing that.
Absolutely, and certainly the players doing that is something that's very good to see, but you mentioned that is more important than the AFL having structures and policies and training programs about these issues. The AFL has taken a pretty strong stance on anti-doping, alcohol, gambling, illicit drugs, respect responsibilities, racial and religious vilification. Why has it not yet taken that same step with regards to GLBTI issues?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's actually not quite right. Back in 2009, the AFL... we'd obviously had a rule in place around vilification, racial and religious vilification, which was sort of a long-standing rule. And in 2009, we amended that rule to include vilification for, in relation to sexual orientation, preference or identity, as well as other things. So we have moved in that space, and we've backed that up also with education programs at AFL club level and also at community club level. So we've got a lot more work to do, but I think we have taken steps in the right direction.
Andrew, I think one of the biggest things it is when players are coming out in support of this issue, whether they be coming out of the closet themselves or coming out in support of people who are gay, support's a really big issue. What kind of support have the players that have already come out in support of this issue received from the AFL? What kind of support mechanisms are already in place that they're receiving?
Well, we've just given them general support and encouraged them to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's fantastic for Brock and Daniel when they marched earlier this year. Mm-hmm. And then we've just provided different avenues for the players, particularly with this campaign, to enable them to help share that message. And they're using all various forms of social media to do that, and we've promoted that on our website. Mm-hmm. And I think at some of the games later this week or on this weekend, there'll be some TVCs, one from Through Beyond Blue and another Say No to Homophobia, that will be playing at the stadiums over this weekend.
Andrew Demetrio has said that the AFL is ready to support any player that is ready to come out. Look, I think that's fantastic, and certainly everyone's waiting. But is that the belief across all levels of the AFL? And do you think there's enough support in place if a player were to come out, given the huge amount of media interest that would be generated from such an event?
Look, I would hope that there would be the support and that it would be welcomed, because I think that's where we should be. But I mean, I think in the end we won't really know until it happens. Mm. But I would hope that as an industry we've sort of evolved enough and are sophisticated enough and are welcoming and supportive enough to enable that, for a player, if they wanted to do that, to be able to do it.
Yeah, well, we're at a stage where we're seeing a lot of players from different codes, not the AFL, but different codes from around Australia and around the world, players coming out. Have you learnt any lessons from those kind of incidents, those kind of events where people are coming out? Has the AFL been looking at them closely?
Yeah, look, we have, and I think what we've sort of noted is that the support and welcoming that the players that have done that have got has been great. Mm-hmm. So we would hope that the AFL industry would be able to do that and be welcoming and supportive, and I think they would be.
And most of those players, though, to interrupt there, Andrew, have been players post career.
Yeah, so. No, that is right. We do note that, but there was an example only a couple of weeks back in the NBA with Jason Collins. So mm-hmm. I think that's great that's happened, and we will continue our education programs at all levels of the game to make sure that when it does happen that welcoming and supportive that support is there.
With regard to the programs that you do run, if I were to type the words gay or lesbian or GLBTI into the AFL website, it comes up with nothing. So there is no way that someone might actually search to find out what the AFL's policy on these issues is. And to type in sexual assault and what have you seems to come up with the list of things about women quite appropriately, but doesn't directly link into GLBTI issues. So I wonder, quite honestly, are you talking the talk and not walking the walk?
No, look, I don't think that's right. And I mean, obviously, you've done that, and your research would be right. But I think we are getting the runs on the board. But I do say that we have got, I said before, I acknowledge that there is more that we can do. But we've got two ex-AFL players on our staff, Luke Ablett and Luke Brennan, who I think you may have spoken to before. But they full-time run education sessions at community and AFL club level. And an important role that they do play is in, educating, particularly at the community club level, those clubs and the players at those clubs about the AFL's vilification rules, but also education about, respect and treating all people equally. So, as I say, I acknowledge we've got more to do, but I think we are starting to get the runs on the board. And those guys in those education sessions have spoken to over 10,000 players at community club level over the last two seasons.
Andrew, I know there are those educational processes in place at all levels of the game. Do you know what the experience of homophobia is at leagues outside of the AFL, particularly, say, rurally or, say, junior footy? Like, are there different areas that you really need to be focusing on where you've noticed that the homophobia is more entrenched? Or, do you have that understanding across the different levels of the game?
Or is it not being reported at all because the mechanisms don't necessarily feed upwards?
Mm. Yeah, look, we have a sort of a decentralised structure in terms of the way that the local leagues operate, because they do operate sometimes quite independently of the AFL, but we do provide the education sessions for them, and there are procedures in place via AFL Victoria and our state affiliates for issues to be dealt with. But we haven't seen any one area where it's more entrenched than another. So I think we just have a general education program across the board.
We're speaking to Andrew Dillon, the General Manager of National and International Development and General Counsel to the AFL here on Gay News Week this evening. Andrew, where are we sitting with the Pride Round? How far away is it? Is there wheels in motion? Is it happening or is it not happening?
Well, it's obviously not happening for this year because the fixture's been set and we've done that. But there were, I understand that there were discussions earlier this year about potentially one match during the year being sort of termed a Pride match. That hasn't happened. But I think a couple of the clubs, and particularly with the lead shown by our Players Association and the players, I don't think it's far away.
And what impact have you found with, the other rounds that you've had previously, so say the women's round that's in place, I think there's an Indigenous round.
There's a multicultural round.
So what impact has having a round dedicated to one particular group or area that you're looking at in the game, what impact has that had on the game more widely?
Oh, look, I think the impacts are many and varied. And, I'm parked outside the MCG at the moment because we're having the first ever women's national football draft this evening, starting in just in a few minutes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Melbourne and the Western Bulldogs on June 29 are going to be playing, obviously, their senior AFL game.
Yes.
But a curtain raiser to that will be, for the first time ever, there'll be a Melbourne team and a Western Bulldogs team represented by women, and we're actually having the draft tonight in about 5 or 10 minutes.
So the draft is actually for that particular game?
For that game. So we've had 250 nominations from around Australia, and we've got a fair bit of interest in it, and it should be, quite interested to see how it all goes, and we'll have that game, as I said, on June 29. So, women, if we look at women's in particular in terms of other things that have happened, we've got 136,000 females out of our 860,000 participants. As a segment, female is our fastest; it's got the fastest growth rates. So it definitely does. Having that focus in a round it does have positive aspects.
Do you think we'll see a rainbow draft in the future?
I don't know about that.
That was just a light one to end on. Not genuinely pushing for that at this stage.
Andrew Dillon, the other aspect of work that I think falls under your purview that I've quite liked outside this place, I'm an emergency nurse, is a lot of the stuff you've done around safety and concussion and the like. So I think that's a really important bit of work. I just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah, and I'd just also like to add to that, we have talked a lot on this show about the work that the AFL is doing and discuss whether it is the responsibility of that group to be taking these measures, but I think it does make an enormous difference. We've seen great results from the AFL players certainly stepping up. So,
All right, Andrew Dillon, the General Manager of National and International Development and General Counsel to the AFL, thank you very much for joining us on Gay News Week to discuss this. We understand you're very tight for time.
Thanks very much.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Gay News Week.
Yes, it's Jeffrey, Caddy and Matt with you this evening.
The Youth Support and Advocacy Service, YSAS, has recently launched a queer youth withdrawal program. It's the only one of its type in Australia, and it's designed specifically to support young GLBTIQ people aged 12 to 21 who are experiencing issues with alcohol and other drugs. Very lucky to be joined in the studio tonight by Lindy Heron, residential youth AOD worker at YSAS, and also from YSAS, Michelle Mifsud, who's a nurse there. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Hi. Thank you. Hi.
First of all, can you please explain what YSAS is?
Okay, so YSAS is, I would say, one of Victoria's leading youth drug and alcohol support services. So we have, which is where we work, in a residential withdrawal program. Mm-hmm. We also have outreach programs, a rehab program. Help me out. What else do we have?
Youth justice. It's also, as Lindy said, is throughout Victoria. So there's they're based in La Trobe, Geelong, Bendigo.
Yeah, we have another resi down in Geelong, one over in Glen Iris.
Cool.
YSAS seems to be quite inclusive service. Is it a GLBTI only service, or does it cover other things? And my second question is, 12 is a very young age to start. Can you address both of those points?
Okay. First of all, we're not GLBT exclusive. It's for young people, but we're totally inclusive of GLBT. But we run these specialist withdrawal programs for the GLBT community because some young people out there are afraid of discrimination and homophobia and accessing services. So that's how that came about. What was the other part of that question, Jeffrey?
12.
I don't know if we've had 12 years old, but we've definitely had the youngest. 14. But they're definitely, I think within Geelong and rural areas, there have been 12-year-olds accessing services.
So what does the program actually involve?
So the queer-specific program?
Yes.
Okay, so at the moment we're running it for 10 days. So it's a 10-day program for young people that identify as same-sex attracted or gender questioning to come in a safe and supported environment to address substance use issues, but we also address other things while they're there as well. So we acknowledge that some young people have mental health issues, homelessness issues, justice issues, all that sort of stuff. But I guess primarily our core business is clinical withdrawal in a safe and supported environment.
And what kind of activities do you hold at these events? Like, so what kind of things are you really actually doing?
Apart from, as Lindsay said, apart from dealing with withdrawal, health, mental health.
Is that discussion based or is it more practical? Like what are you actually doing?
Oh, practical. Okay. It's practical. So when we get young people in, that we're checking for like bloodborne viruses, STIs, talking to them about mental health, addressing most of these clients do have anxiety, depression. So linking them in with the service if they're not already linked in, referrals to other services. Yeah.
Cool.
Excellent. So there are certainly a lot of challenges that I would imagine GLBTI youth would state about accessing mainstream services. How do you ensure and access the kids so that they know to come to you for services?
Where do they find out about this kind of thing?
Well, this has been one of the things that we've really tried to push so much, I guess, in this particular one. This is our fourth. So we've put out an ad in MCV, full page spread that we got. We're here. This is fantastic. Yeah. Bringing us on here to talk about it. But I guess a lot of it is working also accessing other services, both mainstream and queer specific, and getting word out that we're seeking referrals and just trying to get word out to the community in general.
Do you think schools are a good place to be kind of talking about this and kind of getting into it? Is that the right place where you're going to find the best people that need this kind of program?
I think so. We haven't approached schools in the past, but I actually think that there is a need to do that for future programs, because I think we are missing pockets of the community. And I definitely think that would be on the agenda for next time, approaching schools.
What's the feedback, if any, that you've received from, so this is your fourth program that you're running currently, so the three previously of the young people who have been through the program, both in terms of having something that is a proper withdrawal program, but also something that's GLBTIQ specific?
Well, a few of the young people that we've had through the program before have stated that they would not have accessed the service had it not been specific to their needs. And then what has been great about that as well is that they have actually come to our service during the program, met the staff, seen what we're about, and then have felt comfortable to come back outside the queer-specific times and into kind of mainstream general service times. And I just wandered off there. Sorry.
That's okay. About the service model, it's described as a clinically supported withdrawal service. How would that be different to maybe a rehabilitation program? Or what are the differences in the language there? What does clinical supported withdrawal include? What does it not include?
Okay, so when clients come in and they may be alcohol dependent, they'll need a medicated withdrawal. And also if they're using opiates, they'll need a substitution therapy. So we're there to either help them withdraw in a medicated or... I've gone off there. Sorry, I tapped the table.
No, that's fine.
So on a medicated.
Or stabilise. And then once they've, withdrawn or stabilised on a replacement therapy, then they go on to rehabilitation. And that's when they look at why they use drugs and look at their history and work towards, and that's a long-term thing. That's sort of like 3 to 6 months you'd be looking at with rehabilitation, whereas we're just getting them off the substances.
Do you know anything about rates of substance abuse among GLBTIQ youth as compared to non-GLBTIQ youth, and what the specific, are there any specific issues that you're dealing with within that that are different? Or is it just more about providing a safe space that they can come to go through this process?
There's definitely higher rates of the GLBT young community using more amounts of drugs than non-GLBT community.
2 to 4 times higher. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Statistics show. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I wasn't sure of the number. So you can take
So in response to that, I got lost again. Looking at the fact that the rates are higher, because yep. which is also associated with the prejudice and homophobia that some of these young people have experienced in the community or from services.
When they finish the program, is there the opportunity, what's the process in terms of continued rehabilitation and also potentially linking into other support services related to sexuality?
So at the moment, there is no specific rehab, queer-specific rehabs available in Victoria that I'm aware of. Mm-hmm. But we do have there are multiple rehabs available if they wanted to go down that path. Some people want to go back to the community and see how they're going to go on their own first. Mm-hmm. We also offer outreach, and so there are other ways that they can have continued support.
Yeah, cool.
In the community.
How is YSAS supported? Is it supported? Where do you get your funding from? And are you supported by other different community groups as well at the same time?
Well, we're a not-for-profit independent organisation. Mm-hmm. Some of our funding does come from DHS.
Yep.
And Medicare.
Yep. But essentially, the program is free for the young people.
Right. And it's volunteer-run, is it? The people who are running this course?
No, it's... Okay.
Cool.
So this is the fourth one that you're running mm-hmm. to date. If anyone was listening and wanted to find out more information about how they could get involved mm-hmm. or be a part of the program or refer on to the program, how would mm-hmm. they go about doing that?
They could call us on 1-800-005-501. That comes direct to us mm-hmm. at the residential unit. Or they could go to the website and have a look as well, which is www.ysas.org.au.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Thank you very much to the both of you for coming in and talking to us about this this program. It's something that's really important to be going on, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's fantastic. And we've had great responses from the young people.
Absolutely wonderful. You're on Gay News Week.
Gay News Week.
Yes, it's Katie, Jeffrey and Matt this evening. It's now time for the Gay News Week GLBTI National Affairs Roundup.
It certainly is. And bisexual, transgender and intersex dementia, what about us? There is going to be a conference held to consider Alzheimer's Australia's strategy, which is called The Tiles of Life, Colouring the Future. It's about how Alzheimer's is managed and perceived and what goes on with it in the aged care sector in Australia. So it's a really important issue. And the conference, which goes on the 14th to 17th of May, is in fairness underway at the moment. Mm-hmm. But I thought we'd give it a mention tonight just because it's something I think we should try and follow up at some point in the future. And I think it is just such a big issue for our community.
Yeah.
The ageing of our community has had a lot of focus with some law changes recently, and I think this is about moving it beyond gay and lesbian into the smaller parts of our community.
Yeah, it's important to note, especially when we're talking about aged care within our community, that there are different issues that face our community compared to other communities. So it's important to highlight that.
And some may not affect all of us in the community yet, but we still need to look at them. Okay, Living Positive Victoria has invited everyone to stand together as a community, speaking of community, mm-hmm. With 1,200 other communities worldwide to commemorate the 30th International AIDS Candlelight Memorial. So this is set for Monday the 20th of May and basically is a memorial for all partners, friends, family and community members that have been lost to HIV/AIDS. So a great initiative there.
This is a huge thing for our community, and it's going to be hosted by Rachel Berger, who's a comedian, novelist and television entertainer, and there's going to be a whole heap of other performers helping out with it. It's at the Positive Living Centre, so help
In South Bank, so yes, you can refer.
Do RSVP. Mm-hmm. That is the request. You can call 9863 8733 or just visit the Living Positive Victoria website.
Certainly, and it is that time again where the lovely people at Pride in Diversity are awarding their most GLBTI-friendly employer. If you've been following Gay Newsweek over the years, we actually last week spoke to Dawn Hoff about who is the most friendly GLBTI employer. And yeah, they're about to announce that this year's one.
Yes, so the special people at the event, Michael Kirby, Jason Ball, of course, the anti-AFL, anti-homophobia campaigner, and of course, Bob Down.
Bob Down, lovely.
Yes. So, look, it's a great initiative. It's in partnership with ACON, Diversity Council Australia, and various other organisations. So 41 employer submissions for this year's award, up 62% on last year, with 18 first-time employers signing up. So that's great.
It certainly is a good event, and it will be a good event, and I am going to be there as Joy's representative.
Oh, good on you.
I'm flying up to Sydney on Friday for it, so it'll be great.
Absolutely.
And I'll come back with a report.
That'll be great.
Look forward to it. And as always, it wouldn't be Gay News Week if we weren't talking rainbows. And of course, there's been...
Yay, rainbows.
Rainbows. There's how many weeks in a row now has it been?
I think it's been
83 weeks. the latest developments in the rainbow situation. Sydney City Council had a vote on whether we should erect a permanent rainbow flag in Taylor's Square. Do any of you know what actually happened there?
It was voted down.
Yes, voted down. That's the correct answer.
And they're going to hold a forum.
Yes.
Because
we're not the only ones that won't let this issue die, it has to be said.
We've gone from permanent rainbows that then had to be removed from the street at a cost of $130,000. We then had a situation of people spontaneously putting chalk things on, people getting upset about them, and then having to get them washed off. And that didn't...
That didn't fly. So now we thought a flag...
Which would fly.
Which would fly, but now that's no good. So what about a badge? I nominate someone wears a badge.
Just make some badges up, you reckon?
Yeah, just a little bumper sticker, maybe.
No.
We could do a run of 10.
Yes.
You can, of course, follow the campaign online like I've been doing over the past few months, I think it's been now. Hashtag DIY rainbow.
And, of course, we'll keep you up to date with all the results from the forum as soon as they come to hand.
It is something that we are not going to let go of here at Gay Newsweek. I think that's about time. And that's all we've got time for the National GLBTI Affairs Roundup.
Great shows, great topics, great radio. Joy 94.9.
It's now time for the International Affairs Roundup here on Gay Newsweek. And as always, we're joined by Andrew Potts from Gay Star News. Good evening, Andrew.
Hey, guys.
Andrew, of course, more is happening in the world of gay marriage with news announced out of Minnesota, Brazil, and also Italy.
That's correct. So Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton, he's officially signed gay marriage into law on Tuesday. This is a state where only a year ago they were looking at actually banning same-sex marriage. So there's been a fantastic turnaround there.
Mm. Where's that turnaround come from?
There was an election and a lot of seats changed hands, so the whole makeup of the legislature there's changed.
Okay.
And what's going on in Brazil on the gay marriage front?
Brazil now essentially has national gay marriage.
The
country's highest court has ordered that government offices across the country, they can't deny marriage certificates to same-sex couples. The government still has a bill that needs to be voted on, but it really doesn't matter if they pass it or not, because any couple now in Brazil that wants to have a same-sex marriage can just walk into a town hall and do it.
They can just do it. They didn't have to do anything. They can just do it now.
And I mean, you know, this is the most populous country in South America, so it may even be that now that a majority of the people in South America have access to same-sex marriage.
I mean, and this is a huge country with a pretty conservative Catholic background, so it's interesting that they've made the way before us, moving to Italy.
Okay, here's another conservative country. The city of Milan has recognised the first overseas civil partnership in the country. The situation in Milan or in Italy is a bit like it used to be here, where a lot of local governments have set up relationship registers, but they don't actually have any legal standing. But this is the first time an overseas couple. So it was actually an Italian couple who travelled to the UK to get married. They'd taken 70 friends with them to the Globe Theatre in London to get married. And then the whole trip, I think, costs almost $100. So obviously, their guests might have had to pay a little bit more. And then they just headed back, and they took the case to court in Milan, and the tribunal said they should be allowed. So that's a little step in Italy.
Is that under European law? What was the context of that?
They sued the city to allow same-sex marriage. Sorry, to register their relationship like it does other couples.
Okay. Yeah. And another story out of the United States has a congressman's spouse being properly identified the same as an opposite sex.
He's no longer just a friend of that congressman.
Special friend.
That's right. So up until recently, congressmen who have same-sex partners, those partners were only registered on a guest ID. So Democratic Representative Mark Pecan, his husband Philip Frank, has become the first spouse of a congressman or woman to receive, same-sex spouse to receive a spousal ID. This is a decision made by the Congressional Sergeant-at-Arms. Up until then, they hadn't been allowing it. But Pecan enlisted the help of Democratic House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi to get it done.
Nancy got the job done.
Now, there are actually two other Democrat congressmen who have same-sex partners, but neither of those have married their partners, so they're still not eligible because the US doesn't recognise de facto relationships.
Right, they're still friends.
This is the bit out of the story that got me, is that whilst he can get into the House of Parliament as the partner, he's still not entitled to all of the other benefits that would be eligible if he were an opposite sex partner.
That's right. So until the Defence of Marriage Act is repealed, and there's a good chance that the US Supreme Court will do that in June, he can't get any financial benefits that he might if he was a woman married to a man or vice versa.
Now, Andrew, uplifting news. Linda Harvey from the Anti-Gay Mission America says websites like your very own Gay Star News lead children into questioning their sexuality, or rather, turn them gay.
Yeah, so what she said is that homosexual-themed pornography is extremely accessible to young people if they ever visit any websites covering the gay agenda as news.
Right.
So she's saying that they might click on some of the ads.
They might. And
if they happen to be browsing the gay news.
And that the ads
poor little heterosexuals get confused.
Yeah, and the ads would then make them feel aroused, and they confuse that with being born gay, which is, of course, a lie.
I find it really interesting. I'm just having a look at your website at the moment on Gay Star News. The only ads that I can see are gay-friendly hotels that's a music festival or something. So it's clearly very homosexual behaviour we're talking about here.
Is it making you feel a bit more gay?
I'm feeling quite gay. I'm feeling the need to express my homosexuality, and I'm questioning my sexuality indeed.
And she also said that Hollywood and even the top leaders of our country are all busy selling homosexuality to kids, and this message has the ability to stir feelings in a young person that were not in play before.
I just found a home design ad on your website. That's really helping.
Can I just say that your editor, Tris Reed-Smith, has said, and I have to mention this because it is speaking about that which I love. Mm. When I was little, I got all my headlines from the news flashes on the Muppets, and I've noticed my eyes bulging recently, my skin growing yellow fur, and my hands waggling around randomly. I'm just mentioning that because I love the Muppets.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it does just go to show, this is ridiculous. Funny for us, but
funny
ridiculous.
Funny for us who have perhaps sorted out who we are and aren't trying to work our way through the quagmire of stuff that's out there. But for kids that are questioning, this is pretty unpleasant language.
Yeah, and I have to just say one other comment that she made was she argued marriage equality, this was back in April, will victimise children and put them at risk of more disease, more anxiety and depression, which, of course, is a ridiculous thing to say as well, because we know that it's for those particular experiences that we need to be supporting young GLBTI
people. But in fact, it isn't being gay that causes all of those things. It's homophobia causes all of those things.
That's right. Anyway.
Sorry, just a little platform there.
Very, very good point indeed.
Then lastly, good news again. The American Family Association spokesman, Brian Fisher, has refused to comment on whether he has ever experienced same-sex attraction.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with all these people who are so obsessed, you always wonder if maybe they're not covering for something. But
well, then sometimes you find out they are as well.
They're spending a lot more time being interested in my sex life than I think sometimes I am, and that's a little disconcerting.
Yeah, so Brian Fisher, he was on the Alan Combs show on Fox News Radio.
Oh, good.
He was asked about his choice to be heterosexual. Mm. Combs asked him if he'd ever had a same-sex impulse, and he flatly denied that he would talk about it. He said, I'm not going to talk about that. I'm not going to go there. Give it a rest. And
he might have had that impulse when he was trawling through the Gay Star News website, do you think?
And Combs has then gone forward and said, well, you know, maybe if you've been able to overcome your gay impulses and you've been successful in doing it, you could become a model for other people. Mm. So he said, but Fisher said everyone experiences sexual impulses, that if they acted on those, it would destroy them. But he refused to give an example from his own life.
Mm. I find it really interesting. This is the same man who suggested in 2012 that children with same-sex parents should be kidnapped, which I find it's an interesting...
To protect them from being raised in that sort of environment. Yeah. So he is another member of that side of the American right, which just keep feeding us material week after week after week, really. Yeah, it's really quite disconcerting.
I guess on that note, we'll have more crazies for you next week. Andrew Potts from Gay Star News, thank you very much for bringing us the International Affairs Roundup here on Gay Newsweek.
Anytime.
You're listening to Gay Newsweek on Joy 94.9.
Yes, you certainly have. It has been Katie, Jeffrey and Matt this evening, but we've almost run out of time, but we've had a couple of messages come through.
A couple of messages, well, from Scotty. So he said, hey guys, love the show and thank you for all your good and informative work. Keep it up. Thanks, Scotty. He's also said, I truly hope gay marriage happens soon. And do you know what, Scotty? So do I, because then we can stop talking about it.
So true.
We do a lot of gay marriage on this show, but, you know, we're supporting it.
We were just saying that we're going to have to write to Julia and Tony and say, for goodness sake, just sort it out. You're on the wrong side of history because we want some new content.
Well, I know. And the international news roundup, it's like another one. How are we going, Australia? Same old.
We're still talking rainbows.
Even the flag got voted down.
This has been Gay News Week, but unfortunately we've run out of time. I'd like to thank Shannon Gillies, who's been helping online with us this evening. She's been tweeting along. If you don't follow us on Twitter, at Gay News Week Joy, she'll be doing a lot more things into the future, and I'd like to welcome her aboard.
Indeed. If you would like to suggest topics during the week, not about marriage, email gaynewsweek@joy.org.au or look for us on social media, Facebook and Twitter, and we do have an encore presentation on Tuesday nights at midnight.
But until next week, we are
Katie Larson,
Jeffrey Devine,
and myself, Matt Thompson, and this has been Gay News Week.
You've been listening to Gay News Week. Check out joy.org.au/gaynewsweek for all of the links on how you can keep up to date with the team on social media. And be sure to tune in next Wednesday from 7 p.m. right here on Joy 94.9.
Want to know what's going on in our diverse community? Tune in to Joy's range of current affairs programs.
7 p.m. Mondays, Generation Next.
Tuesdays at 7, Salt and Pepper.
7 p.m. Wednesdays, Gay News Week.
And Thursdays from midday, On the Line.
Thursdays at 7 p.m., Rainbow Report.
Then again on Saturdays from 10 to midday, Saturday Magazine.
And across the week, the Community Network News team bring you the Joy 94.9 GLBTIQ News Wrap, a look back at the news of the week in our community.
Yes, we have one of the longest running in-house news services on community radio, bringing you the latest every morning, midday and evening.
Be informed and empowered through your news and current affairs lineup on the gayest station in the nation, Joy 94.9.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.